All right, so the thing I want to start out talking about is the synchronization. And whenever you're writing a concurrent program, you need some form of synchronization. And fundamentally, synchronization is all about forcing some threads to wait on other threads. So concurrent programs generally spend a lot of their time waiting. So there are a lot of ways you can structure this, and by far the most common, possibly because it's the most well understood, is to use locking. And in the simplest case of a global lock, you have one thread accessing shared data at a time, and the rest all have to wait on the lock. So this is really straightforward to get right most of the time, but it gives you very minimal concurrency. So if you're looking for performance, this isn't it. So you can have fine-grained locking, and this tends to be the most common solution for when you're trying to get more performance out of your concurrent program. You use different locks for different data, and you get what's called disjoint access parallelism. When you're accessing different data, you can run in parallel. So you're reducing waiting by allowing multiple threads to proceed, but you're running many expensive synchronization instructions just to implement these locks. So the result of those instructions is that you're waiting on memory, you're waiting on the bus, you're waiting on cache coherence, you're still doing a lot of waiting even if you have no actual contention between threads. So another common approach is to use reader-writer locking. And the idea here is you can say, well, let's not make readers wait at all, at least not on other readers. So unfortunately, readers still have to wait on writers and vice versa just to avoid disrupting each other. And the effect of that is that you still have to run the same expensive synchronization instructions, and the overhead of running those will dwarf your actual reader critical section. And the result of that is you really don't get any reader parallelism. Your readers will get serialized. And I have some performance results later in the talk to show that you really don't get a performance win for using this in most cases. So what about something like non-blocking synchronization, which we've seen a lot of talks about that kind of thing in the past here. And it's right there in the name. It's non-blocking. So that means you don't have any waiting, right? Well, not so much. It turns out you still have to run expensive synchronization instructions like compare and swap, load linked store conditional order to do this. And on top of all of that, there's a more subtle problem. All but one thread that's accessing shared data, it has to retry. You're still doing disjoint access parallelism. And on top of that, you're getting useless parallelism. You are still waiting, but instead of doing it spinning in an efficient loop, you're doing busy work that you have to throw away. So at best, what you're going to get is equivalent to the finest possible granularity of fine-grained locking, which is nice. And it has various non-performance related properties that are nice, but as far as performance goes, it's not still giving you a win. Then there's transactional memory, which has seen quite a lot of research. And the fundamental idea here is let's make non-blocking synchronization easy, because it really isn't to begin with. It is sometimes implemented using locks for performance, or sometimes using optimistic concurrency with non-blocking synchronization. But the key idea is it theoretically has equivalent performance to non-blocking synchronization. In practice, it tends to have a little bit more overhead than that. But it's really just fancy generic abstracted wrappers around waiting. You're still waiting, spending a lot of your time waiting. So how do we stop waiting? How do we get better performance? Well, reader-writer locking is the one that had the closest to the right idea. You don't want to do any waiting. But readers in reader-writer locking still had to use synchronization to wait on writers. And in order to even check for potential writers, even if there weren't any, you're still spending some time waiting. So could we avoid synchronization entirely? And we don't want our readers to be waiting at all. And in particular, could we get joint access parallelism? Could we let concurrent readers and concurrent writers access the same data at the same time with no synchronization? Can we do that safely? So what does at the same time mean anyway? Well, on a modern system, you have a shared address space, but your memory is fundamentally distributed. It's close to one CPU, not close to the other. It's all far away on the bus, except there's close versions in caching. And what you have is the very expensive illusion that you have coherent shared memory. And the hardware goes to a great deal of trouble to make this as inexpensive as possible, but it has limits. So at the same time, tends to get rather fuzzy. And on the other hand, shared address spaces make communication really simple. You don't have to send explicit messages around. You modify data, and anyone interested in that data will see the change eventually. And because of all the effort gone through to maintain this illusion of coherent shared memory, you have incredibly optimized communication via the cache coherence protocol. It's ideal if you don't have to do that communication, but when you do, it tends to be a pretty efficient way of communicating. So when we do have to communicate, let's take advantage of that mechanism, and not just to make message passing go faster, but to take advantage of shared addressing and shared data structures. So that's where our approach of relativistic programming comes in. And we use that name by analogy with relativity, and specifically with the idea that you want to avoid having an absolute reference frame, everybody agreeing on what memory contains at any given time. So in particular, we don't enforce a global order on events that are not causally related. Two different readers can see unrelated events in different orders, and turns out it doesn't tend to matter most of the time. So readers, therefore, can do no waiting at all. They don't have to wait on other readers, and they don't have to wait on concurrent writers, which means they don't have to do expensive synchronization. So we minimize communication, we minimize synchronization, and when we do have to do any waiting, we'll push all of that off onto the writers, just because there are a lot of workloads where read performance is what we really care about, and we know how to make those scale now. So in particular, the result of this is that we can make linearly scalable reads up to as many threads and cores as you can throw at these algorithms. So the problem here is, what happens when you're running concurrent readers and writers? What if a reader sees a partial write in progress? Well, our approach is that it's the writer's job to not disrupt concurrent readers. So data structures have to stay consistent after every write. You go from one consistent state to another consistent state without saying, oh, well, I can be inconsistent in the middle because I've locked out readers. You don't get to do that. So writers will order their writes when they are causally related by waiting, and they will wait on readers to make sure that they are observed in the order they expect. And the nice thing about this is that there is no impact whatsoever to concurrent readers by doing waiting in a writer. So the general outline here is, I've given an introduction to synchronization and our approach to relativistic programming to try to avoid waiting. I'm going to walk through some of the synchronization primitives that we use, some of the data structures that we've constructed in the past. Then I want to walk through the specific algorithm that I'm presenting today on how to make concurrent resizable hash tables, present some performance results, and outline where we're taking this in the future. So first of all, there's a relatively simple set of synchronization primitives in relativistic programming. We have readers that are delimited. They note when they start and when they end. This is a purely local, efficient operation. It involves no waiting. So it's not, may I proceed? It's, I'm reading. That'd better be OK. And we have the ability for writers to publish a pointer. And this publication operation is an ordering operation that ensures that anything you initialize will then be initialized when someone reads the pointer that they accessed it through. And this abstracts over having to deal with the details of memory barriers. And finally, we have an operation where updaters can wait for readers to finish. And in particular, this waits for existing readers and not new readers that show up. So it can't starve the writer by making it wait forever. So I want to give a couple of examples here. If you're doing an insertion into a linked list, so you have this simple linked list, you want to insert the new element B. You have readers that could be looking at any point of the list at any time. So you first initialize the node you want to insert to point to the right place in the list. And then you can publish the pointer. And that publication ensures that the readers which reach B will see its next pointer being valid. And as the moment you publish it, readers can start seeing that element. I'm going to be using this same convention throughout the talk of dashed items being things that the reader can't see yet, that are in private space for an updater. To do the reverse, if we want to remove an item from a linked list, then we again have to be careful to not disrupt concurrent reads. So we first route around that node in the list that removes it from the list for all future readers, but you can still access that node if you already have a pointer to it, and that pointer is not invalidated just because we routed around being able to reach it in the future. So now, if we wait for all of the existing readers to finish, we know that no new readers can have a reference to that node, which means we now know there are no references to that node, and now we can garbage collect it. So all of that happened without ever blocking a reader. So we have a lot of existing relativistic data structures. We have linked lists, we've had radix trees for a long time, we've had tries of various types. More recently, we've had balanced trees and hash tables. And the issue with hash tables, though, is we do have a lot of operations supported. We have open chaining, which we have linked lists, so it's easy enough to put a linked list in a hash bucket. We support insertion and removal, and some of my previous work created an operation for atomically moving a node between two hash buckets because you need to change its key. But what we don't support yet, or didn't support yet, is how to resize a hash table. And this is a necessary operation for maintaining a hash table over the long term in a program to maintain its constant time performance and reasonable memory usage. So in particular, though, we want to resize while maintaining consistency at all times so that we are allowed to do it while a reader can run. So the existing approaches to resizing a relativistic hash table, and there are a lot of resizable hash tables out there. I'm talking specifically about the approaches to resizing these hash tables using relativistic programming. The biggest approach has been not to allocate a fixed size table and never resize it. This has been the approach that the Linux kernel uses for its directory entry cache. Guess that you have 4 gig of memory, so you must need about this much of it for your directory entry cache. I hope that's good for the lifetime of how long you've booted this machine. So you either get poor performance because you fill it too much, or you get wasted memory because you use too little of it. The other approach is kernel developer Nick Piggin developed a approach he called dynamic data structures. And in that approach, you keep around a pointer to the old and the new data structure and force readers to check both. Unfortunately, that means that readers also have to not only check both of these, which slows down the common case, but check whether a concurrent resize occurred to make sure that they haven't missed an item that was moved while they were reading. And so this slows down the common case, it forces readers to wait, and it significantly slows down lookups while you're resizing. The other approach is that Herbert Zhu developed a resizable relativistic hash table for use in the Linux kernel, but this approach involved putting extra linked list pointers into every single hash table node and effectively doubled the memory usage of a hash table. So this is usable on a small scale, but it's not a general purpose solution because it has extremely high memory usage. So one interesting question is, what exactly do we mean by keeping the data structure consistent for concurrent readers? Well, a reader traversing a hash bucket always has to observe all the elements that should appear in that hash bucket. But if it observes a few more elements, it will just skip by them, no harm done. So we're going to define an imprecise hash bucket as a bucket that contains elements that belong in other buckets. And as long as it still contains everything it's supposed to, this is an acceptable situation in the short term. So we can use this as a transition state. So with that, I want to walk through the algorithm for shrinking and expanding a hash table. So say we have this very simple hash table. It has all of the odd numbers in one bucket, all of the even numbers in another, and we want to shrink it to have all the numbers in one bucket. So this is our initial state, and we start out by creating a new bucket to hold all the all of the items in the table and point it to the first item that's going to be in that bucket. Well, that'll be the one here. And then we link the old chains together. So now we have a single chain which threads through the entire table, or the entirety of the buckets, that, the items that should go to that bucket in particular. And that means that the new table is now immediately valid. The old table, however, is also still valid because it has all the right pointers. The odd bucket will chain through more elements, but the readers can ignore them temporarily. So then, once we publish the new buckets, the readers can start using the new table immediately. But of course, readers may be looking at the old table. So we wait for readers to finish. Well, now they'll only be looking at the new table, and now we're allowed to garbage collect the old table. So we've kept the table consistent at all times, but we've been able to resize it. Now, it turns out shrinking is the really easy case because all we have to do is thread through multiple elements. Expanding gets a little bit more complicated. So say I've got this state where I have all of the elements in one bucket, 1, 2, 3, 4. I've actually interleaved them here because otherwise I'd be making it too easy on myself. So to expand a table, I'm going to go ahead and create odd and even buckets and point them to where the first element that's supposed to go in that bucket. Well, this is immediately a valid hash table. It is a little bit unusual. It's interleaved, but the buckets are all valid. And each one just contains more elements than it's supposed to contain. So once we can immediately publish these new buckets, and the reader is immediately allowed to start accessing them and proceeding with the new table. So at that point, we can wait for readers, and the old table will no longer be accessed. So I'm keeping it around here because we're going to use it as auxiliary storage. The other thing worth pointing out here is now element 1 can only be accessed through the odd bucket. So here, the odd items are going to be white, the even items are going to be black, and all of the items in gray can be still accessed from both buckets as part of an imprecise hash chain. So at this point, we start uninterleaving the buckets. We unzip it by one step, and we use this auxiliary pointer to remember how far we are in this process. So now the odd chain skips element 2, and when we wait for readers to make sure we don't disrupt anybody who was walking along that chain, then now element 2 is only on the even chain. Well, we can repeat that process, unzip again, and wait for readers again, and we continue that process until we get to our final state, at which point we can throw away our auxiliary data. So we've taken an arbitrary hash table with elements in one bucket that need to go to 2 or 3 or 4 or however many integral factor you expand by, and uninterleaved those so that we can turn it into a valid hash table that's been expanded. So in order to test this approach, we implemented a benchmark, a micro benchmark, as a Linux kernel module because, conveniently, it has a good implementation of read, copy, update, which is the mechanism we've used to implement our relativistic programming primitives. They map directly to operations provided by read, copy, update implementations. So we started with a baseline of saying, well, how expensive are hash table lookups to begin with before we do this work? And then we do continuous resizing as a worst case scenario of saying, okay, in the worst case, how much do we impact concurrent lookups? So we compared our algorithm, the dynamic data structures approach, and regular reader-writer locking as a baseline. So the net result of this for the fixed size table, where we haven't tried resizing yet, is that this is the result I mentioned before. Reader-writer locking does not scale at all. Note that there are no writers in this diagram at all, only readers. And despite that, they get no parallelism, even though they're allowed to proceed in parallel. The overhead of running the lock takes up so much overhead that it doesn't provide any opportunity to run in parallel. The other two algorithms, the relativistic programming algorithm and the dynamic data structures, both get good, roughly linear performance. The knuckle in the graph here at 8, going down up to 16, is this is a 12-core box with hyper-threading. So at some point, you start going beyond the limit of hardware cores. So at this point, we're getting slightly better performance, again, because of our lower overhead in the common case, but it's about neck and neck. So once we start continuously resizing, though, first of all, reader-writer locking disappears into the axis, so I haven't shown it here. dynamic data structures suddenly start performing a lot worse because they may have to retry because a resize occurred. And even when they don't, they have to check both data structures, which slows down the lookups. Our approach gets effectively no performance impact and continues to scale linearly to the limits of hyperthreading anyway. So one other result I want to show is what happens when you are doing continuous resizing versus the fixed size tables that you're resizing between. So here I'm showing 8K buckets, 16K buckets, and a continuous resize between the two. With our approach, you end up falling between the two as you would expect. Well, if you're continuously at the larger table size, then you're going to have less work to do for each lookup, so you're going to do better. But we are performing as you would expect in between the two and not getting any extra overhead. The dynamic data structures approach, on the other hand, has a significant performance impact for resizing to the point where it performs worse than if you just left the table at the smaller size. So it gives you an idea of the performance impact. And hang on a minute, though. This is USENIX. We don't settle for micro benchmarks here. We care about real-world implementations. So that showed the algorithm and the baseline for how well the algorithm performed. But what about some real-world application that used it? Well, I used Memcached as an example of an algorithm that is powered heavily by a hash table. It is, in effect, a hash table hooked up to a socket. So it's used very heavily for caching, it's very performance critical, and it uses a global table lock. This is sad. So I modified Memcached to use relativistic hash tables. I used, in this case, the user space implementation of RCU called URCU by Matthew Desnoyers, and it is a very good example that RCU is not limited to the Linux kernel anymore. I added a fast path for the Git lookups that uses a relativistic lookup. It doesn't have to acquire the global table lock. I tried not to do widespread edits to the entire code base. I focused on having a fast path for Gits that used relativistic lookups. And in order to avoid holding a reference after you drop the read, I went ahead and copied the value out of Memcached. And this still gives you a reasonable result. It requires doing a little extra work, but that is, work is a constant factor rather than a limiting factor for concurrency. And anytime you hit one of the cases of key expiry or cache eviction, then I fall back to the slow path, so no big deal. And the writers use safe relativistic memory reclamation, as shown much earlier with linked lists. They reclaim memory safely. So the result of that is that Git performance, rather than leveling off after a certain number of concurrent processes, ends up continuing to scale linearly up to the capacity of this machine. And the performance impact to set is fairly minimal. And again, it's a bit of a constant factor, but you don't see it dipping down sooner. So beyond that, where we want to go with this in the future, beyond hash tables, is that we want to be able to do arbitrary data structures. Currently, if we want to build a relativistic data structure, we have to do some very careful algorithm construction. But what we have now is a general methodology for algorithm construction, where you can assume a certain memory model, write your algorithm to that model, and then we can apply a mechanical process to place all the barriers, all the wait for readers operations, and you don't have to think about it. So to sum up everything, the approach generally of relativistic programming allows you to have linearly scalable readers that don't have to do any waiting. Relativistic hash tables, which have existed for a while now, it's now possible to support resizing with this algorithm, which was pretty much the last barrier for general purpose usage. And finally, real world code, as shown with Memcached, scales better using the relativistic programming approach. And with that, I'll take any questions you have.
Rajarangaswamy, Florida International. This is intriguing. I have a clarification question. You said that readers don't need to wait at all, but writers wait for readers. How do writers wait for readers?
So the writers wait for readers by using an operation that allows them to check whether there are concurrent readers running, using that same system I mentioned, where readers will make a lightweight notification using purely CPU local operations to say, I'm running, and later, I'm no longer running. And using read copy update, which is an entire talk in and of itself, but the key primitive is that it can roll up that information into a globally accessible bit of information that tells you, have any of the concurrent readers that were running at the time that I started waiting continued to run, and at the point where they no longer run, the wait operation can finish. And that operation can be implemented very efficiently, in particular, very efficiently for readers. Does that answer your question?
Right. I'm not very familiar with RCU, but it seems like when you have two readers running at the same time, let's say one started before the other, and the first guy said, I'm running, right, set some bit to one, and then the other reader also sets the same bit to one.
And that's not quite how the implementation works. It actually tracks how many readers are active.
Okay.
And it tracks it by CPU for efficiency reasons, but it does actually track the number in and the number out and effectively says, here's my line in the sand for where I started waiting for readers to finish. Make sure everybody who was running before then all finishes.
Okay.
So
it's something like a semaphore, it seems.
In a way, but the implementation details are a whole other talk in and of themselves.
Right.
I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit more offline of how it can implement that efficiently, but the short version is it can implement that very efficiently.
Right. At a high level, it seems like readers must do some kind of waiting to synchronize the number of readers that are active at any point.
The only answer I think I can give you is, turns out they don't. They,
okay.
You can track using purely CPU local operations. You can say, on this CPU, there are this many readers by doing a non-atomic increment and say, okay, new reader. And you roll up that information asynchronously without doing any expensive synchronization.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Hi, I'm Asar from Promit. This is very interesting. If I understand you correctly, your main focus here is read-heavy data structures, is that correct?
It is true that we started out with a primary focus on read-mostly data structures, and that tends to cover a large number of possible applications, but we're definitely not limited to that, and in particular, I should mention that the definition of read-mostly can vary depending on how much overhead you actually have. And with a lot of our algorithms, you can have as little as a 5-to-1, 2-to-1, even 1-to-1 read-to-write ratio and still get a performance win. And at the point where you cross that point of no longer getting a win, it's still not a significant loss. So it depends on what your workload is, but it doesn't have to be ridiculously read-biased to get a benefit from this. Does that answer your question?
My follow-up was basically just what happens as you push the more writers toward more readers, and how does that compare?
As you push more and more readers through, then at some point, the other way around, as you have fewer and fewer readers, on the one hand, the wait for readers operation will take less and less time, but it still has a non-zero overhead. So if you really are focused primarily on write performance, you are going to get a slight performance impact to writers, and if writers are most of what you're doing, you may care about that slight performance impact. So again, it depends on your workload, but it's not that any one thing will get more expensive. It's that the assumption that it's okay to make writers a little bit more expensive to make readers a whole heck of a lot cheaper no longer holds when you don't have very many readers and you do care about that tiny bit more expensive on writers.
Thank you.
Thank the speaker again.